Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
You know, anybody in their right mind would probably just want to build a new building because it's so much easier, but it's a much greener thing to do to fix an old building because it already exists, you know, than to build a new one. So it's a kind of admirable exercise. And I think it's one we should all, you know, we look around our city and see plenty of empty buildings that you could imagine could get radically reused in different and more creative ways, hopefully.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Richard Olcott, design partner at Ennead Architects in New York City, with offices also in Shanghai and Los Angeles. Over the last four decades, Richard has developed an award-winning body of work for leading cultural, civic, and educational institutions around the globe. His work is grounded in the power of architecture as an interpretive medium, one that can communicate the complexities of contemporary society and create a lasting cultural impact. Some of his notable projects include the Bing Concert Hall at Stanford University, the Anderson Collection at Stanford University, Yale University Art Gallery Renovation and Expansion, Zankel Hall at Carnegie Hall, the New York Times printing plant, WGBH headquarters in Boston, and the William J. Clinton Presidential Center. He was recently inducted into the National Academy of Design. The project we will be talking about today is the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg Center in Washington, D.C. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Hopkins Bloomberg Center, a monumental achievement in architectural repurposing and academic design, is located at 555 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., where I am going to go check it out in June. This transformative project, spearheaded by Johns Hopkins University, has breathed new life into the former museum building, turning it into a 435,000 square foot marvel designed to foster collaboration, dialogue, and the exchange of ideas.
Well, so the first interesting fact probably is that we designed the original building. So this is for us a very unusual occurrence where we renovated our own building. So that is why Hopkins came to us in the first place, since we know where all the bodies are buried and, you know everything about the building. And I would say, I mean, I know they've always had a presence in Washington, D.C., in the northwest part of the city, in a bunch of not very adequate buildings. And I think when this came on the market, they jumped on it because of its location. the museum, the newseum, I think was finished in 2008. And it was a museum of journalism and dedicated to the First Amendment. But it cost $25 for a ticket to go to the museum in a city of free museums. So it was never a very good business model, probably. So they decided to sell the building. And Johns Hopkins jumped on it primarily because of its location on Pennsylvania Avenue, halfway between the Capitol and the White House. A fantastic location.
While adaptive reuse typically refers to repurposing an existing building for a different function, Richard and his team coined the term radical reuse to capture the transformative nature of this project.
I guess I've always found the term adaptive reuse to be a little inadequate for some of the buildings we've been thinking about, like the one we're about to talk about. This is something I've been thinking about for a long time. About 20 years ago, I was fortunate to win a Rome Prize, and I went to Rome to the American Academy, and I studied what I would call hybrid buildings. And by that, I would mean a building that has been radically transformed to something that is beyond what it was originally and has become something else entirely. For example, the Bath of Diocletian, the Roman bath, was changed by Michelangelo into a Renaissance church of completely different use. Or the Theater Marcellus was a Roman amphitheater, which then became a medieval fortress, which then became a Renaissance palazzo and is now a very fancy apartment building. You know, so these are buildings that long since have lost whatever semblance they had, their original configuration, and have become something entirely different.
Navigating Washington, D.C.'s zoning regulations presented Richard and the INEAD Architects team with numerous challenges and hurdles.
Washington is the most overregulated city in the world, one of them. Every cornice line, every elevation is specified very, exactly. And that building fills that envelope completely. Then there is the big window that was actually a big kind of recess. And we needed more square footage in the building. So it's about 420,000 square feet, the whole thing. We actually removed a great deal of floor area and then put it back. And we're able to infill the big window and get that additional square footage, putting more program on the facade, which is actually classrooms and meeting rooms and lounges. So we did everything we could to kind of work within the existing envelope to get more square footage, because we were not allowed to go out beyond it by 1 inch. The regulations are pretty much exclusively for the exterior of the building, fortunately. And we were the ones charged with designing the exterior of the building and also getting it through all of those agencies. And there are a legion of them. The Commission of Fine Arts is the most important one, the National Capital Planning Commission, the National Park Service, the State Historic Preservation Office, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think it was an open question for Johns Hopkins that what if they couldn't got this approved? Are they going to still buy this building? So that was a kind of chicken or egg problem for a while there. And the most difficult was the Commission of Fine Arts, certainly, who are the ones really charged with making the big aesthetic decisions of places like Pennsylvania Avenue. And they were the ones who said, you need to make, this is an opportunity for this building to become a better neighbor to this historic context. And they held us to that. And we had to convince them of that. So conversations with things like stone, that's how that came about, was solving that problem for them. And they control every aspect, every material choice, every brick, everything is a subject to their purview. So it's not easy.
The building, often described as a vertical quad, features an array of amenities, including a theater, cafe, conference center, libraries, student lounge, and active learning classrooms, all interconnected through a series of innovative design concepts.
I think the big reason that they purchased the site, the primary user is the Hopkins School of Advanced International Science. And so that's their big foreign policy, foreign affairs school. very prestigious. And for it to be right in the middle of the federal city with all of these embassies and, you know, government buildings around is ideal for them. It also has their business school. It has various other departments, including a beautiful auditorium that their Peabody Institute uses for music. So they've really been able to consolidate about 8 different programs and have a major Washington, D.C. presence in this location. We did completely rework the ground plane and made it much more user-friendly. There's a whole new set of planters and seating areas. There will be a cafe that opens out onto the wider part of the sidewalk. It's not finished yet. So I think Ann Hopkins was very concerned that they'd be much more welcoming to the public than the previous building was. And that's also at night as well as in the daytime, because there are lots of evening programs. And that makes everybody very happy, because at night, Pennsylvania Avenue is pretty dead. It's more of a daytime place.
A key objective of the Hopkins Bloomberg Center was to establish a fresh identity that not only distinguished itself from its former iteration, but also seamlessly integrated with the prestigious neighboring structures, each steeped in architectural pedigree.
I think if anything, we're trying to make a new statement. Even Johns Hopkins is very concerned that people not think of them as, oh, they're in the old museum building. And so they were looking for a new identity. One of the things the old building had was a giant plaque that had the whole First Amendment written on it in stone, you know, about 75 feet high. It's a huge surface there. And that kind of identified it as the museum immediately, that and the big window looking into it. It is also, I should point out, on this part of Pennsylvania Avenue, it is in the company of some very important buildings by very good architects. Next door is the Canadian Embassy by Arthur Erickson. Across the street is the John Russell Pope National Gallery of Art. And next to that is I.M. Pei's East Building of the National Gallery, which are all super famous and beautiful buildings. So, you know, this is a pretty fancy neighborhood. You have to kind of, you know, straighten up, I think, when you build in a place like that. So, but primarily what I said in the beginning, to make a new identity, a more progressive one for Johns Hopkins, and to be a better neighbor with those other buildings was our goal.
No pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
Commissioned in 2019, the Hopkins Bloomberg Center is the brainchild of Eniad Architects, Rockwell Group, and Smith Group, who collaborated carefully to create a dynamic space. The most important aspect?
Dialogue. I think that's something, it's actually a kind of Bloomberg hallmark. It's where this comes from. It's one of Mike Bloomberg's ideas, is to go find a bunch of smart people and put them in a room together and make sure they talk to each other. So, and we had not worked together before. So, you know, it was not so easy at first, I think. But there was also on one hand, you could say, well, we were supposed to do the outside and Rockwell was supposed to do the atrium, you know, parts in the inside. And Smith Group was supposed to be the architect of record and do a lot of the classrooms. But in fact, it was far more porous, the boundaries, than that, as it should be. And we worked together on all of those things. So we contributed to the interior, they contributed to the exterior. You know, we worked together and it was fun. It's a team sport, what we do. So that's the way it has to be.
At its core lies a soaring atrium adorned with a cascading room stair that links the academic floors, encouraging movement and interaction among students and the faculty. This central hub, aptly dubbed the Beach, serves as both a gathering space and a nod to the iconic sloping lawn of Hopkins Homewood campus.
The beach in particular is something, if you ever went to the Johns Hopkins campus in Baltimore, or the sort of central quad, there's a big oval lawn that's sloping, and it's called the beach, and it's the kind of place where everybody goes. So one of the innovations that we were able to work with in this project, with, in particular with David Rockwell and his people, was to kind of recreate that central gathering space as a basically a step stair kind of, you know, bleacher seat thing. And it's called the beach because it's very similar function and kind of idea of place. The interior was transformed as much as the exterior. In particular, you know, it was once just a big atrium with a flat floor and a few things hanging in it and a giant window that you could see from Pennsylvania Avenue. And it was effectively a big party space. And now it has been injected with all kinds of new programs. So there are literally classrooms and meeting rooms that are floating inside of the big space. And that's what is being referred to this, like, so the room stair is a series of classrooms that have a stair winding around them all the way up and down. And the bridge one is literally a bridge that has a conference room hanging from it. So those are all things that activate the atrium in a kind of amazing way.
The vertical quad system was critical in overcoming one of the building's biggest challenges.
Getting the number of classrooms that we had in there and getting that mix to work properly, it was literally a puzzle to fit that all in there. It's a kind of a new paradigm for a university building. It's kind of like a high-rise vertical quad. That's what we meant by that. It's kind of a typical university quad turned on its side. So making that work is a different kind of thing. There's a lot of people in there that need to, you know, move around it. So it's not like college when we went to college at all. Okay.
On the exterior, the center's design pays homage to its surroundings, incorporating elements like pink Tennessee marble and a new glass curtain wall to complement neighboring architectural landmarks.
Both the National Gallery and the east wing of the National Gallery are Tennessee marble. So we use the same stone from the same quarry. So that right there kind of brings it together and it makes it work as a better neighbor to those buildings. The previous building was primarily a glass building. And I think it was always a kind of outlier on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is much more of a masonry and stone avenue. And that was something that one of the commissions we were charged, you know, with going through was very concerned that we maybe fix that issue a little bit and be a better neighbor. So the way that primary material of stone is, it gets you halfway home already, I think, just by changing the main material of the front. Then we changed a lot of the glass. There's actually a lot of that glass was previously single layer and not sustainably, you know, performing well at all. It's all now with inner layers of copper mesh and things that block down the sunlight and, again, make a warmer palette that works with the kind of masonry, brick and stone that is on the avenue. So those are all devices to try and make it fit in with the context that's around it.
The structure features rooftop decks with newly installed decking, planters, and supplementary terraces, offering additional amenity space.
There's actually three roofs. The building steps back and higher as it goes away from the avenue. And up there is a whole conference center, there's a kitchen. You know, they could have big events. I went to a Bloomberg event it's called City Lab, and they get mayors from cities from all over the world. So they had like 200, 300 mayors from literally all over the world. And they're having a conference all day, then they have dinner, and they use all those terraces to kind of go in and out. It's very lively. It's great. There's a whole membrane roof on the top of which is a whole paver system and planters. And it's completely redone, the whole roof. It's really, there's some wood decking, lots of great plantings. It's really nice space. And there are other terraces, one on the second floor, there's one on the sixth floor. There's all the stuff at grade. You know, so there's much more kind of amenity space than there was before for that.
One of the standout features of the Hopkins Bloomberg Center is its sustainability, with revamped lighting, green roofing, and repurposing an existing structure rather than building anew.
The Newseum is a purpose-built museum in which you came in, you bought a ticket, you were ushered downstairs to an orientation theater where you watched a little film, and then you were ushered into an elevator and you went straight to the top of the building, and then you worked your way down through a series of galleries. So a prescribed sequence, very careful prescribed sequence, only one way to do it. And that's about the opposite of what an academic building needs to do. You know, do you think that every hour everybody wants to go every which way? And by the way, those floors are, a lot of them were offset, you know, by half levels. So we removed a lot of floor area and then put it back. We completely changed the auditorium. We filled in that window with new floor area. We completely removed three giant elevators that were in the atrium, the original atrium, and built an entirely new elevator core with six elevators north of that. So it was a huge amount of demolition, selective demolition that went on in there. You know, usually you think of demolition as just, well, let's just take this out. This was more like brain surgery than demolition, I think.
The interior required selective demolition to reconfigure the elevator system, new floor plans, and transformation of the museum layout into an academic layout.
Whole new mechanical systems, all new glass systems, as I mentioned. Certainly all the lighting was redone. You know, lighting has changed so much since 2008. It's far more efficient. So basically everything they could do, they did, you know, to try and improve that. A lot of green roof planting area up on the upper levels. Those are all things that would make it more sustainable.
Selective demolition without compromising the building's structural integrity was the most intricate aspect of construction. It demands meticulous precision over an extended duration.
Most importantly is the collaboration with our genius structural engineers, Lyra, who designed the original structure for the building, which includes, you know, big trusses and things that are spanning across the atrium, a very sophisticated structural system. So they're the only ones who knew how to take it apart without it falling down. Literally, if you talk to the construction management people, I think you'd find they lay awake at night thinking, I hope this thing doesn't fall down, because they were doing that much. You know, you have to shoring up all kinds of parts of the building. If you're taking out the columns that are holding it up, it's a pretty scary thing to do. Very careful, very thoughtful, extended sequence of selective demolition, piece by piece. It took almost a year to do that part. The backside of this building, even though it's a 400 some thousand square foot museum building, the north side of it has 150 apartments as part of the building that are not part of this project. So those all had to stay there. I hate to think how much those people were disturbed, but I mean, we're literally taking down the building right behind them the whole time, and they're living there. So that makes it even more terrifying, the whole thing. You know, anybody in their right mind would probably just want to build a new building because it's so much easier, but it's absolutely, I commend Hopkins for, I mean, certainly they wanted that location, but it's a much greener thing to do to fix an old building because it already exists, you know, than to build a new one. So it's a kind of admirable exercise. And I think it's one we should all, you know, we look around our city and see plenty of empty buildings that you could imagine could get radically reused in different and more creative ways, hopefully.
I'm definitely, it seems to me, seeing a lot more of that these days. Even some drastically old buildings being really just turned into something completely new and updated, but still an old building.
Well, that's the irony of, you know, lots of the older buildings are the ones that are much better made and last longer, you know, and now they've come full circle to become something else. So they can, and they can become something else because of that.
Considering the extensive scale and complexity of this project, along with the substantial transformation, I was intrigued to learn about Richard's favorite aspect of the endeavor.
Well, I'd say the theater, certainly, but I'll tell you what, the roof. The best thing in the building is the view. And the view is a knockout when you go up to the very top and the Capitol is right there. It's just astonishing. And you can see it actually on the fourth floor is a series of classrooms, one of which has a big window facing the Capitol. It's just spectacular.
The Hopkins Bloomberg Center represents a significant achievement in architectural repurposing and academic design. With its commitment to sustainability and innovation, it promises to shape the future of urban academia while fostering collaboration and dialogue among students, faculty, and the wider community. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insights from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Richard thought about how this project of radical reuse might push architectural design forward in academia.
I think we all believe that it represents a new typology for universities, and one I hope we see. You know, it's a real urban campus that's different, very different. And a lot of that has to do with the way you learn now. You know, like a library, there's a big library, but there's no books. It's all digital, you know? So, but there's somebody you can talk to, but that's the definition of a library now. It's, you know, it's like a comfortable place to read with somebody who knows what they're talking about that you can talk to. So there's lots of new, very different things going on as the future is here.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Richard. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I'd say it's both personal and professional. That's why we come to work every day. That's what we believe architecture should be in this office. Our senior partner, Jim Polshek, who passed away last year at the age of 92, always talked about architecture as a healing art, as a piece of the social construct, and dedicated his life and work to building in the public realm. So we don't ever do, you know, trophy houses for billionaires. We don't do that kind of stuff. You know, we do buildings that try and make a difference. And that's what gets us up in the morning, I think, to do that, to make whether that makes a musician play better or in a concert hall or a scientist laboratory is, you know, going to make him achieve better and discover something. That's why, you know, we want to provide the means for that to happen, those things to happen.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.